with different communities together, experimentalists, different kinds of theorists who usually don't talk to each other. And I think it's been great. So I think we should thank the organizers. Thanks. Now, I'm not going to summarize. The organizers have given me an impossible task. Because the meeting was so diverse, and because it's very difficult to go to the whole conference at an institute where you work and where you have responsibility. So I apologize to the people, the speakers whose talks I didn't hear. But you're in a much better situation when you're in a conference away from home than a conference at home. And in any case, there was too much to summarize. The only way I could imagine of done it was like a conference I went to, a technology entertainment design conference in Silicon Valley, where at the end of the conference, they brought up a professional comedian who just simply parodied each of the talks in order. But I don't have the talent for that either. And in any case, I knew that Giovanni would basically give the summary conference, the summary talk. Part one, and then there's part two coming. So what I'm going to do is just a little bit of cheerleading about what it is that, at least from one point of view, has been under discussion here, and what we have accomplished is, I always forget how this thing works, but it's not bad. Then I want to talk about some challenges and questions for different theorists. I think the experimentalists are way ahead of us, and we should ask ourselves some hard questions. And I'm going to pose some questions, which I think are among the questions should be asked. Then I'm going to use the opportunity, since that's really most of what I have to say in the way of a summation, to be the advertising supplement between part one and part two, and advertise a point of view about DSR as arising from quantum gravity. Now, I understand that Jurek is going to present something like a derivation of DSR from quantum gravity, so maybe this is a preview, although I have no idea how he's going to do it. I'll present a point of view in which I'll argue that a version of DSR does indeed come from quantum gravity. If I still have time and I'm still alive after that, and then I have some various provocative things to say about extending our reach and our ambition and our imagination about where to look for quantum gravity phenomenology. Okay, so first, many of us here at this conference are in a good mood. And we're in a, at least let me speak for myself, I'm in a good mood because I remember very clearly the days before about 10 years ago when conferences in quantum gravity and papers in quantum gravity always came explicitly or implicitly with the apologies that there was no chance of experimental test of anything. And people said things, and a few people who haven't gotten the message still say things, like to test quantum gravity, you would need an accelerator the size of a galaxy. And therefore, blah, 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 you know, Anthropics, Landscapes, blah, 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 blah. Okay? About 10 years ago, a few people, and Giovanni was I think the most effective of them, began to say, look, guys, we have access to an experimental apparatus much bigger than a galaxy because we detect cosmic rays and gamma rays coming from cosmological distances. And these are performing experiments all the time, for example, by their possible interaction with, quote, space-time foam or space-time structure, their possible interaction with the cosmic microwave background at very high boost. And if we're clever, meaning if they're clever, maybe there's some possibility of testing hypotheses about quantum gravity, if not really testing theories. And I remember I was shocked when I first heard this. What the hell is Giovanni saying? It can't be right. And it turned out a few other crazy people had said, you know, been saying about the same time things like that, like Coleman and Glashow and Gonzalez Mestre. And but then it was really a hope. I mean, the hope focused on the idea, as Giovanni has explained, that we could test at order L Planck times energies or L Planck times energy squared. We could use high energy astrophysics, and it also hasn't been much mentioned at this meeting, but also high precision laboratory experiments to test for example, the fate of Poincaré invariants. So one reason to be in a good mood is that this idea has really matured, and as we know from at this meeting would not have been complete without the discussion of some experimental results. Okay, so here's one way to frame, it's not the only way, but here's one way to frame, and I apologize because I'll be saying this at the beginning of my talk, some of the same things that Giovanni said at the beginning of his talk. So the key observational question is, what is the symmetry of the ground state? And from the point of view of people who think about induced gravity or analog models of gravity or emergence of space-time structure, this is just standard condensed matter physics. When you do standard condensed matter physics, the most important question is, what is the symmetry of the ground state? And if the space-time geometry is a condensate of some more fundamental degrees of freedom, which one way or another, I think most people who think about quantum gravity believe, the most fundamental question is, what is the symmetry of the ground state? We should emphasize that even in classical general relativity, this is a question that has to be phrased that way, because even classical general relativity has no global symmetries unless you truncate it artificially to add boundaries or asymptotic regions, which is not relevant for the real world, that is for the cosmological case. Okay. So it's an important thing to emphasize. There are formal statements that underlie this, for example, the proof by Karl Fukas that the configuration space of general relativity has no killing fields or no even conformal killing fields. General relativity has no symmetries. Therefore, any symmetry that we observe a consequence of is a low-energy dynamical phenomenon. It's even in classical general relativity a property of the ground state and not the theory. Hence, in any quantum theory of gravity that has classical general relativity as a low energy limit, the symmetry of the ground state is a dynamical question. Anybody who thinks they put it in, I think, has not been thinking about the problem deeply enough. Okay. And importantly, it's the first experimental question that is shown by the talks at this meeting we have access to. Now, there are, roughly speaking, three possibilities for the symmetry of the ground state. One is that it is the same as the symmetry of the ground state of classical gravitation or classical general relativity. I'm assuming we're neglecting the cosmological constant, but you all know how to correct Poincaré to anti-de Sitter or de Sitter in the appropriate case. That the symmetry of the ground state of quantum gravity is just Poincaré invariance. Okay. And the most compelling aspect of string theory is that at least in flat 10-dimensional space-time, that is achieved at least to second order in perturbation theory, and that's very profound. Okay. Another possibility that for many people who thought about it is compelling is that there just is a preferred frame when you go down to a more fundamental scale. People who think about foundations of quantum mechanics and think there's a more fundamental theory, a non-local hidden variable theory, or Bohm theory, or a spontaneous collapse theory, often end up believing that there's a preferred, there's really a preferred reference frame. And many people who think that classical space-time is a condensate in some more fundamental theory think that Poincaré invariance is only a classical or low-energy approximation, because in that more fundamental theory, there's unlikely to be locality. Everybody is likely to be talking to everybody else in a way that has nothing to do with the locality of space-time. And so there is some global time in most people's conceptions of a more fundamental theory that general relativity or space-time would be a condensate of, and therefore fundamentally Lorentz invariance is broken by some preferred frame. And there's a lot of people in this room and out of this room in the field who have thought about that and advocated that. Among those not in this room who's been a very strong advocate of it, this is Ted Jacobson, but there are many others. Then there's a third, and I'm emphasizing that because it's not, the story is about to be rewritten in such a way that that was a dumb idea, I'll predict. But it wasn't a dumb idea. A lot of provocative and compelling thought has gone into supporting that point of view. The third point of view, which is the newest one, is deformed Poincaré invariance, or doubly special relativity broadly, which has antecedents, but again, Giovanni was the person who really forcefully brought it to our attention and compellingly formulated it. And I'll be describing what it, there's a lot of confusion about what it is and what it means, and I'll be arguing for a point of view about it shortly.
Symmetries at all?
What do you mean, like you break rotation invariance?
Yeah, I mean there's no symmetries of the rest.
Sure. Of course, there are never only three possibilities. Just for the principle of a discussion, it's nice to say. Okay, here is what DSR means from one point of view, which is the point of view that I think about it and that I would advocate we begin. Okay? And that is, as a modification of the principles of special relativity, which adds to the two principles of Einstein, two more which are there and which are not taken away, the relativity of inertial frames and the invariance of a speed or a velocity. The two new principles are also the invariance of an energy scale or a length scale in quantum physics. And the fourth principle is that c is the universal speed of photons in the limit of energies small compared to that invariant energy. Now that includes the case that all photons just have the speed c, but it allows the possibility of an energy-dependent speed of light with natural corrections at order e over this invariant scale e Planck. Okay, so that's what I think doubly special relativity is. Okay, is any realization of these principles?
You expect that if I'm allowed to do arbitrary boosts, I am going to be able to change the energy of a particle which has energy that is lower than Planck energy, as to get it as close to Planck energy as I want? Or there is something
that, as you know very well, that happens in some realizations and not other realizations. This is, for me, the minimal statement of what we mean. There are many deviations and versions. The situation is too confusing, in my view.
Just
so there are, there are higher than E Planck and lower than E Planck fundamental particles, and they might be more differently.
You don't need to put the E much more than E Planck. You can say in the infrared region. That's objective. If you say in the...
Well, no, but this is objective, too, because E over E, since E Planck is invariant, that it's E being small compared to E Planck.
Well, but it might not be objective to all observers.
You're wiser than me. Thank you. Okay.
So you mean four more ways?
They're the same things, just move.
Are you...
By the way, a Terra changed some of these transparencies when I wasn't looking, so we'll see.
Are you expecting the... a particle to move at the velocity c always, or not necessarily?
Not necessarily. Okay, now, there are some robust consequences, okay? In many, when I say robust, there are some common consequences in many but not all realizations of this. One sees modified energy-momentum relations, momentum space described by having a constant curvature, which gives a meaning to that invariant energy scale, and energy momentum conservation involved becoming nonlinear, because, if you like, the momentum space is a curved manifold.
Sorry to interrupt. Are you saying that you're keeping speed of light constant?
I'm keeping a velocity constant, which may or may not be the speed of a photon.
Because the speed time is not an invariant in special relativity.
Yes, so this disagrees with special relativity by principle three.
You have to break special relativity.
It's not, the point, John, is that it's not a breaking of special relativity because of point one. There's still the relativity of inertial constant. And the key question that writing down these principles poses is there a deeper version of special relativity relevant for the Planck length? And is it, for example, possibly a limit? One way that some people, for example, Urich has argued this, is that there should be a limit of quantum gravity in which h bar goes to zero, g goes to zero, but the Planck mass, which if I remember right, goes like the square root of h bar over g, or the reverse, goes to a constant. I mean, it matters, but I'm not...
And blackboard is cursed. Because this macroscopic body?
There's a million questions that arise. Okay, I'm not here in my first slide going to answer every mystery about DSR, like the soccer ball problem. Okay, I'm just trying to formulate a discussion in which we can argue about those things. Okay, if now everybody introduces their preferred worry and thought about DSR, this will be the last transparency I show. Maybe that's what the decent summary of the conference. Okay. I will mention many of the difficulties and confusions.
You introduced the symbol E flag there and M flag there. Are you making a distinction, namely when you make your...
No, no.
Are you in a frame when you make your list 1, 2, 3, 4, and E prime refers to an energy, or...
I'm being sloppy about that.
Let me ask my question. Yeah. Well, does the inverse of E prime refer to an invariant, the inverse of an invariant distance scale?
This way of thinking about it, okay, in this way of thinking about it, you still have the constants C, H bar, and G, which are constants. So I can say what I said, and that implies, since quantum mechanics is relevant for the nature, that implies the existence of a length scale. There's a lot of talk...
Invariant
length scale. There's a lot of talk that motivates this, like this is a way to realize...
I'm just wondering if there was a malice of forethought in the...
No. Don't make the mistake with me of ascribing cleverness to what's most likely accidental. But, you know, there's a lot of motivation that has been given about, you know, in quantum gravity there should be some short distance cutoff for 14 different reasons. And, you know, string theory and perturbation theory is one way it seems to accomplish that, consistent with Poincaré invariance. And here's a way to accomplish it, which so far is not tied to any theory, is a different way that might... might also be true for string theory. I know of a couple of so far distributed papers that claim that this is a limit of string theory, which I wish those people would distribute. But anyway, these are the generic consequences. Okay, now there are different mathematical or not so mathematical realizations of these ideas, and I'm just mentioning that, especially for people who have not been aficionados of this, because you'll get really confused because there are 15 things which are called DSR. It has been realized through the idea of deforming the Poincaré algebra into a half algebra, which acts on a space-time manifold which is non-commutative. And that's probably, as Giovanni said, it's the most studied case. There's been a lot of studies of that. There's also the idea that it's realized by the metric becoming energy dependent or scale dependent, as in the sort of idea that the metric is really, if the metric is something emergent, it's really basically a bunch of coupling constants that tell you how low energy fields interact with each other. So the metric should be thought as a pile of coupling constants, and therefore that should run under the renormalization group, and therefore be scale dependent. That's one argument that motivates me to that. Then there are others as well. There's Sabina's idea that these should be replaced by the speed of light becoming a function of the energy, h bar becoming a function of the energy, always involved with this invariant scale, which I think is a very elegant way to summarize some features of some DSR theories. I think an important question, and I'll raise it again, that those of us who think about DSR should do is understand, is there really one, this one idea, are there really 15 different versions of it? Are they all actually just different, related to each other? Are they not related to each other? We should start to clean this up. Okay. There are models of DSR as well. I'm sort of distinguishing formulations from models. One question is there any complete quantum, interacting quantum field theory in which DSR is a symmetry, asymptotic symmetry or low energy symmetry? And it's very important to know that the answer is yes, and it's 2 plus 1 gravity coupled to matter. This has been understood from many different points of view. Sandra Baez and collaborators understood it since a long time ago from one point of view. Most recently, Terra and his collaborator, who we all know, Laurent, have re-derived it within a spin foam approach to quantum gravity. But it's very important to know that the class of such theories is not null. That's very, very important, because it might be that, for example, there's a lot of work on free quantum field theory, on Kaplan-Minkowski space, or free quantum field theory with DSR symmetries, some exploratory papers on interactions, but it's plausible from a lot of the work that maybe there just aren't any interacting quantum field theories which have these kind of symmetries. And it's very good to know that there is a real interacting theory that does have this symmetry. And then there are different models under construction. Okay, now, I've been listening to Giovanni for a long time, so it's not surprising that what I thought was going to be a punchline of my talk, he anticipated. How can we experimentally distinguish these three possibilities of exact Poincaré invariance, broken Poincaré invariance, and doubly special relativity or deformed Poincaré invariance? And it's, so again, I hope I'll say it a little faster than I would have said it because Giovanni took the time to say it. We have three theories, three hypotheses we want to distinguish, and we have at least three classes of experiments. So let me go through this. So we have the ability with experiments in progress to distinguish at order L Planck and perhaps in order L Planck squared between these three possibilities. There are basically two effects of all these possibilities. These are sort of the leading order low energy quantum gravity effects in this limit. The limit of corrections to energy momentum relations, which may lead to an energy dependence of the speed of light, and modifications of the conservation laws. And then there are some basic consequences, preferred frame effects. So in theories with preferred frames, there are things that can't happen in relativistic theories, like photon decay to electron-positron, for obvious reasons. There are modifications of thresholds, GZK and TEV, and energy dependence of the speed of light, and so forth. And we have learned at this meeting that these can be measured to order L Planck. So just in case somebody is just coming in, let me talk about the energy dependence of light and emphasize, this has been, of course, been said, this is why I get to repeat things, because it's a summary talk, that because this effect accumulates for long distances and leads, for the case of gamma ray bursts, to time delays on the order of hundredths of seconds, to TEV flares, to time delays on the order of minutes, we have the possibility of bounding the coefficient A there. It's important to stress that this effect could be parity even or could be parity odd. And that's important to stress because the parity odd effect with light has been ruled out by many orders of magnitude past the Planck length, the Planck scale, by fringence, by observation of polarized radio galaxies, and by, more controversially, actually, I'd be curious what the experts think, how well this has stood up, by polarization of gamma ray bursts.
Horne Bolz gave up, basically admitted that their analysis was bogus.
Okay, so it has not stood up. Okay, good.
But anyway, the current limit is the extent to the minus 11 95 contracts, confidence level that one
represents. Yes, yes. And I feel, you know, I'm summarizing, and, you know, Stefano and his collaborators have done crucial work in leading to this point, as has Seth and collaborators and Nicola and collaborators. So a lot of work is behind this statement. But it's important to stress that glass will they tell us be able to see order Alpon parity even effects, that is a delay or an advance of photons with energy at order Alpon. And we even have some other data about that. Now, here's why we can distinguish these three possibilities. Broken Lorentz invariance gives us modified dispersion relations, but unmodified conservation laws. So generically, thresholds move appreciably, and generically, there's helicity odd, energy dependence, and speed of light. Those are generic consequences. Of course, one can fiddle, but we're interested in generic consequences. The formed Lorentz invariance, because it gives both modified energy-momentum relations and modified conservation laws, and if you've not thought about these things before, it's an interesting thing to do to convince yourselves that to preserve the relativity of inertial frames and add terms like order E cubed and order E to the fourth to your energy momentum relations and preserve relativity of inertial frames, you have to add nonlinear terms generically to the conservation laws. And because of that, thresholds generically do not move much, roughly speaking, because they can move in a theory with broken Lorentz invariance because you have terms of the order of the energy of the cosmic ray over the Planck energy, and that's comparable to the energy of the photon over the mass of the pion. But in a theory with relativistic invariance, you go to the center of mass frame, and then your corrections will be on the order of the energy of the center of mass over the energy over the Planck energy, which is much, much smaller and will not compete and move around thresholds. So there's a simple reason for that. And again, as Giovanni stressed, some people you can put into your modification of special relativity the scale 10 to the 19 electron volts and artificially move any threshold you want anywhere, but generically, thresholds don't move. And there's a possible helicity even energy dependence in the speed of light. Possible, and different views from different versions of DSR as to whether actual or not. So to distinguish these possibilities, we have three classes of experiment. Auger tests thresholds, MAGIC and GLAST, and HESS and VERITAS and other upcoming experiments test the energy dependence of the speed of light, and we can test the helicity dependence directly and indeed already have to sufficient accuracy. Okay, I hope you're having fun hearing what you've heard before. Now, so that's why we're in a good mood, and let's just bring it up to date. When some of us first began giving talks about this, so now I want to talk about the GZK threshold, which I think has been described, but just to bring some memory back, okay, so sort of 5-6 years ago when I began including this stuff in my colloquia and popular talks, I was showing this provocative graph from Agassa, which this was a prediction, assuming that sources were uniform, of the GZK cutoff. This is, excuse me, I'm making the standard mistake. This is energy in electron volts, 10 to the 19, 10 to the 20. This is the flux of cosmic rays times the energy E cubed. These are previous experiments, and this was the experiment Agassa. And there were many people, including myself and some people in this room, who got excited and said, wow, we're, GASA is seeing a violation of special relativity. We're seeing, they're actually seeing a quantum gravity effect. Even before, you know, gravitational waves are observed, quantum gravity effects have been observed. Okay. And we said all sorts of naive, exciting things. Of course, the more sober people said, wait a minute, well, there was also some from a long time ago in the sugar experiment in Australia, saw anomalous events, but high-res didn't see anomalous events. And the, you know, fancy people told us, wait a minute, you know, you should trust high-res more than AGASA, so don't be so excited. Last year, OJ started to report, tell me if I get something wrong. Of course, it turns out you knew much more than you were reporting. But you were reporting things like this, and it was clear that OJ, which is the dark blue, was low compared to AGASA, and that to get them to agree, AGASA's energy normalization has to be normalized in decreasing direction, and high-res was somewhere in the middle, and you could look at that and argue about there's no GZK cutoff. There is a JZK cutoff. It wasn't clear. Over this past summer, you guys were reporting this. Am I right? And one sees pretty clearly that there's an increase. This is the famous ankle. And then there appears to be good evidence for a decrease, although I think the collaboration was not saying that you've seen GZK, but you were saying there is certainly a feature in which the highest energy events have a power law which is a lot steeper than E cubed, than 1 over E cubed. Okay. And so finally, in this conference, we heard a report. So just in case somebody wasn't in the room. And for me, this was very exciting. And this is published in Science Today, because here are active galactic nuclei in the red dots, just to repeat, within some number, 75 megaparsecs, if that's right. And the circles are the highest 27 cosmic rays that have been detected. And there's a remarkable correlation, which our speaker quantified in a very careful way, which shamed all of us in terms of how careful the analysis was. And I think, for me, convincing, of course, we're supposed to be tentative and et cetera, and we'll happily wait for new data. But the tentative conclusion, I think it's pretty compelling, is that there is a GZK cutoff. Lorentz symmetry breaking, at least at first order, is dead, although, as Giovanni emphasized, Lorentz symmetry breaking at order, even if the E cubed wasn't there, at order e to the fourth, that second order for photons also predicted that the threshold moved by order one. So that seems in trouble. And DSR, for reasons I said, are still alive, and so is good old-fashioned special relativity. Okay. Is that fair?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I just want to...
For many statements, but it's okay. There is the whole discussion of the effective models, which in fact, the effect of breaking breaks down, which is not DSR, which you didn't mention.
Have patience. I will.
Yeah.
I have questions for you coming.
Sure.
So we'll have a discussion. Okay?
All right.
Okay. Before we do that, I want to just emphasize something that nobody said, which is, am I right, this is testing special relativity up to boosts of 10 to the 11th. And in case you haven't gone through the calculation, that means that 1 second of these cosmic rays is 10,000 years for us. Or conversely, that the Hubble scale contracts to light days. This is a huge burst. Or a centimeter contracts to 100 Fermis to nuclear scale. Okay? Okay? This, I mean, imagine what Einstein would have said if he could have known that his theory could be tested to that extreme.
In what sense are you saying it's 10 to the 11?
The energy in the rest frame in the units of the proton mass. The gamma, that the increase in the energy over the rest energy.
Yeah, so it's 10 to the 12 eV over...
No, it's 10 to the 19 eV.
Oh, sorry. Oh, okay.
I get nervous because I mess these things up, but I think that's right. Okay? And because if special relativity were wrong, of course it's less in the center of mass, but if special relativity were wrong, we wouldn't be justified going to the center of mass. So this is a fabulous experimental result. We have tested a theory at these incredible extremes, and this is one reason why many sensible people thought that it would turn out the other way. And before history is rewritten so that nobody sensible thought that the result would turn out the other way, let me say, I and a lot of people I respect thought the result would turn out the other way. Or could turn out the other way. Okay. Now, we also heard discussion of another experimental result, which I think is very serious and very welcome. And Nick, this is why I told you to wait. But I'm going to emphasize first the experiment. The result is more tentative, for sure. Here are two ways to say the result. So what they do is they observe TeV photons coming from an AGN, from a blazer, and they see evidence that the higher energy photons arrive 4 minutes later than the lower energy photons. And this, you know, is tentative. One reason to understand this tentative is that the experiment binned in 4 minute intervals when they first looked at it. Okay. Then they did an interesting novel, but it seems reliable or interesting analysis where they asked, supposing there was dispersion, that would result in the sharper source becoming dispersed, becoming spread out. Is there then a hypothesis about dispersion which sharpens the source as much as possible? Okay. And they did that and found evidence for a leading order effect at order L Planck or L string. And it doesn't matter, I don't remember the exact number, we can look back at the abstract, but it's a number that's about right for people who think about quantum gravity for a string theory. Okay. Now, tell me if you agree with me, this is a tentative result, but it's very provocative. If it holds up, if it's reproduced in other flares, which I know are being done, it will be, it will be fantastic.
My objection was not about the mass experiment, as you said.
Yes.
That doesn't matter. Okay. Yeah, this is not even a result. At the moment, it's just lower limit, because it's one flare, we cannot distinguish the things from the source and whatever. But that was not my point.
Right, and you guys say that you're doing this analysis of more flares, and undoubtedly there are more flares to come, and so if this is a real result, we will know that it's a real result, and if it's not, it will go away. But two things. One of them is the glass is still coming. We'll do the same experiment in a different energy regime. And second, real experiments are being done about quantum gravity.
Did you say that the EQ term was already pulled out by... Like,
yeah, so what they see is a parity even EQ term. What they see is a parity even EQ term.
You have to be careful with this.
We are. I think everybody in the room is being careful, and everybody. I think the discussion has been careful and responsible. But the important thing, and I'm not a phenomenologist. Okay, there are people who are better able to say this than me. But the important thing is that even when people are careful, there is content to the experiments.
Oh, it would be an AGN mechanism itself.
Astrophysically. Sure, but if it shows up in other flares and if the effect is proportional to the distance as measured by the redshift.
And in glass as well.
For completeness, there is another flare slightly farther away in AGN, you know,
yes.
Seen by S. that I'm doing the analysis, but at the moment there isn't evidence. So the point is that that is even farther away, no? If it is a cumulative.
Okay, if it goes away, it goes away.
Just be, do not get much enthused. Yeah. No?
I'm not, what I'm getting excited about. I am getting a little too enthused. Okay. In fact, I'm going to say what Giovanni said less tentatively because I don't have a responsibility to be a phenomenologist that Giovanni does. If both experiments are correct, and now we're going to have an argument because this is not your interpretation, but it's my interpretation. If both experiments are correct, we have a GZK cutoff. We have a parity even variation in the speed of light and no parity odd variation. And those are, in the discrimination, those are the signatures of DSR.
Yeah, I'm not going to object first. I just wanted to say something which is overlooked usually when you're looking at GZK. These are protons.
Yeah.
So they have a structure.
We hope
they're protons. Neurons, yeah. And whatever. So yeah. It is possible that there is a quantum gravity, of course, huh? There is a microscopic black hole or whatever else. But if you try to calculate the probability of interacting of a microscopic black hole when you have three quarks, a gluon C, and strong interactions present, it might be suppressed. That's all I'm going to say. So it may mean nothing. You have to look at fundamental factors, in my opinion, photons and neutrinos.
There are many things to say, and I'm staying away from so far models. Okay. So I have some questions for people who have different views. Okay. In my responsibility of summarizing, it looks like I'm not going to get to do anything other than that, but that's okay. One, and this, Nick, this really is for you. I mean, effective field theory plus the absence of bifringence says, if you believe effective field theory is relevant, that there is no first order in Alpont Lorentz violation.
Okay.
To claim that this is Lorentz violation, you need to say that you have a theory that even in this limit does not amenable to effective field theory. And I don't want to have that discussion here. I want to say that's a key discussion that the next workshop must have. Okay? I mean, it's come up over and over again in the discussions and comments here, effective field theory versus no effective field theory. There should be a clean perspective on when effective field theory can be evaded, when it cannot be evaded. I think there are cases where it can be evaded, but cases where it can't be evaded. And I think the community needs to have a clean understanding of that.
I do have a model, and I've been having it for many years.
Yeah, but so my proposal is, Nick, not at the level of you have a model and I have a model and they have a model. It's a model independent sense. What kinds of models evade effective field theory in this limit?
If you have decoherence?
I'm not sure. Okay. My answer
is things that.
Decoherence, I mean, people understand quantum mechanics of open systems very well. I don't understand why you can't have a quantum mechanics of open systems with decoupling theorems and effective field theory. Anyway, I'm not doing anything other than saying these are questions we should be able to resolve. Okay. Now, another question is that the issue with second order, much less is known. I mean, there is an argument that thresholds move at second order, which Giovanni presented. I think some of us, and of course, I'm not talking about the experts like Giovanni and Stefano and so forth, but many of us have not focused on second order because we've been focused on the first order. Thank you. Now we have to now I think we should focus on the second order and really get a good understanding of are there theories, interesting theories with Lorentz violation at second order, not at first order. And there may be, that certainly the analog model suggests there may be, but on the other hand, there's a set of arguments that if there really is a preferred frame, the effect should percolate down to low dimension operators, dimensions 1, 2, 3, etc., and should already have been seen. And I'm just mentioning, you know, the experimentalists have done a lot of work and we theorists have to clean up our acts, and these are some of the questions on which we have to do that. Okay, some questions for DSR people. Okay, first of all, the same thing, the language of effective field theory is powerful. One way to clean up the confusion about DSR would be if there was an effective field theory version of DSR. That is, and it's pretty straightforward to see what that might be. That might be where you write down possible terms in the Hamiltonian, organized by invariants under DSR rather than the ordinary Poincaré invariants, and then do the usual dimensional analysis, power counting, and so forth. Okay? And it might be, so I wish I'd done this and could show it to you, but I haven't done it. But I don't, it might be that such an analysis could systematize our understanding of DSR. That is, all the versions of DSR would have to agree at some order, could start to disagree at the next order in some parameter, and so forth. And I think it's important to do that if we're going to be making claims about testing DSR, because nobody knows what we mean, whether we're testing, and Giovanni made this point, whether we can talk about testing some precise version of a quantum field theory in Kazu space, and that's already very challenging to know precisely what one is saying. Okay? But one should clean up these different approaches to DSR and have a more general way of talking about them. And effective field theory is what seems to me like the right philosophy. Another question, there are various partial results about quantum field theory, interacting quantum field theories with DSR symmetry or deformed Poincaré symmetries, and I think the next workshop will have some discussion of that, and it would be nice to have a clean formulation of an interacting quantum field theory on Kaplan Minkowski space, or not. And I've said this before, are there really different versions or not, and is there some universal version or not? Okay. A question for everybody. Is that the places where there are challenges to the use of effective field theory come from non-locality, either wide-ranging non-locality, disordered non-locality, random connections between points here and points somewhere within the Hubble scale, or slight variations of non-locality, as in Matteo Arzano's recent paper, or as Steve Giddings told us about some arguments about non-locality to make quantum mechanics consistent with black hole physics and so forth. And it would be nice to focus on that. Okay. To what extent does there are different kinds of non-locality? Again, we should organize this a little better, and we should understand when non-locality does challenge and does not challenge the use of effective field theory. Okay. And finally, a question for people who work in different approaches to quantum gravity, can we derive any of this stuff? Because this is all phenomenological descriptions. Okay. Now, I think I have 10 minutes. I could, and I'll ask the chair, I could stop now, or I could give a 10-minute sketch of a semi-classical derivation of DSR from quantum gravity. But it's really 10 minutes.
Do you have 10 more minutes?
Okay. Is that okay? And then I won't get to the exciting stuff beyond that, but that's just as well. Okay, so this has appeared in a paper, and it's the first of several arguments in the paper, and it's the most generic. And I present it because it is generic. Okay. And this is basically, there's a lot of formalism here. There's not a lot. There's a moderate amount of formalism, but it's just semi-classical physics. Okay. Now, it happens to use the Ashtakar or the connection variables. That's because they're the ones which are simplest to do these kind of manipulations. I don't think it requires it. Okay, so one has a connection variable and the conjugate electric field, which is related to the geometry, which is a densitized frame field. And I'm just leaving free constants around. So rho is usually the Poincaré square, but it's just a free constant because this is, I want to be as generic as possible. We quantize, the simplest way to quantize a theory with connection variables is with the connection representation. The electric field is the derivative operator by the connection. So this is what we call the connection representation. I'm only going to be interested in semi-classical states. So it is a configuration space of classical connections on some manifold, and there is a Hamilton-Jacobi function, which is the Hamiltonian as a function of A, and del S, del A, being the E's, A equals zero. And there are some Hamilton-Jacobi functions, which are solutions to that. And classical trajectories are of the form A of T and E of T, follow the gradients of the Hamilton-Jacobi function. And semi-classical states are constructed by E to the something proportional to the Hamilton-Jacobi function over H bar. Okay? That's good old semi-classical physics. And I'm going to add some matter fields, some scalar fields, and I'm going to, in the style of the Born-Oppenheimer approximation, or Ted Banks and many other people have studied his kind of thing in quantum gravity at the semi-classical limit, my quantum states are functions of the configuration space of gravity and the matter fields phi, and they're a product of a semi-classical state and another state that depends on the matter fields. Okay. So that's all I'm doing. Okay, so we consider a solution of the Hamilton-Jacobi equations. Okay, associated with the solution is a space-time. And since this is Hamiltonian gravity, there's some slicing, which has a time coordinate, which is related locally to a function which the Hamilton-Jacobi function is the integral of on the spatial manifold. So there's a relationship between the Hamilton-Jacobi function at a point in the infinite dimensional configuration space and a time variable on the solution, a time slicing on the solution, and therefore with some constant mu, d by dt in the space-time is a variation by the dependence on the Hamilton-Jacobi function. Again, if that's everybody with me, this is the standard stuff we do in nuclear physics, condensed matter physics all the time. Except that we remember that the momentum or electric field is a densitized frame field that's related to the frame field one form by some inverse determinants, and the metric then has this form. Okay. What I'm going to argue is that it's necessary in this approximation that when you take the expectation values of these operators, you end up with energy dependence related to the energy in the matter field. And it's a simple argument. The metric is represented by the frame field, which is represented by a derivative operator on the connections. There's a part of that which is along the gradient of the Hamilton-Jacobi function, which is just the momentum of the classical solution, which is the classical frame field, and there are fluctuations orthogonal to that in the configuration space. And again, there's some arbitrary constant there. In any specific theory, there are specific numbers there. We act on a product state. The matter part is in the product. It's a function of the matter field and the connection. And because we can decompose locally the dependence on the connection into a dependence on the Hamilton-Jacobi function and a dependence orthogonal to it, which represents fluctuations, we can write the dependence in the matter field on the configuration connection variable as a function of the Hamilton-Jacobi function integrand and the fluctuations, and I'm going to be ignoring the fluctuations. Okay. By construction, the same operator, d by dA, acting on the semi-classical state just gives the classical frame fields. So if you put together these relations, the operator for the metric or the frame field acting on the matter part, which is written like this, has a part that measures its dependence on the Hamilton-Jacobi function, which is just the time dependence, and another part which is its coupling, its measurement of the fluctuations or its coupling to gravitons, which we're going to ignore. So we understand that the dependence on the Hamilton-Jacobi function in the configuration space cashes out to a dependence on time in the classical solution along a trajectory tangent to the Hamilton-Jacobi function at that point with some pile of constants. That pile of constants dimensionally is a time. Whatever theory I'm doing, the only time in the problem is the Planck time, no matter what version of quantum gravity this is, and therefore, and it happens in particular theories, this pile of constants ends up proportional to the Planck length with some constant alpha. And it's just some constant. In quantum general relativity, it's h bar g. Or it's g, sorry, it's Newton's constant. Okay. Hence, we find that the leading order acting with the operator, and this is kind of what in my, this is my interpretation of what Florian was doing when he talks about quantum reference frames. The metric that represents the frame field has the metric information when acting on the product state pulls out just the zeroth order WKB state times the classical frame field times a term which has the time derivative of the matter field in the space-time. Now, you can show that in the same approximation, the Wheeler-DeWitt equation reduces to a Schrodinger equation for the matter field with some Hamiltonian evolving by d by d the same t. Okay, that's a whole transparency, so I'm skipping that, but I can do that on the blackboard. Therefore, there are solutions to the Hamilton, to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation to the same order, where the matter field looks like either the minus I omega t, where that's the time dependence. Assuming that the space-time manifold is not evolving rapidly itself in time on that.
Excuse me, I'm not following all the way it goes. Isn't what you're stating saying in some sense that if I put two types of matter field coexisting and probing the geometry, the result is going to be different from having one matter field probing the geometry and then some other matter field probing the geometry?
I'll get there. Right. So far there's one matter field, but I have an answer to your question. Okay. Therefore, when there's one matter field and it's in the semi-classical approximation in an energy eigenstate of its Hamiltonian, okay, the metric deforms to pick up a dependence on the energy of that frequency, and it deforms in a particular way. Okay, so we're done. That's the result I just showed. Okay. It can be expressed as saying that the metric, the frame field for the metric at a point in space-time at x and t using these coordinates becomes energy-dependent when it's in the presence of an energy eigenstate of the matter field. Translated to the metric, we do that directly. I won't take the square root of the determinants, etc. And that means that there's a modified dispersion relation and a particular formula for a modified dispersion relation. And let me emphasize that only the spatial part gets modified of the metric. These are the time coordinate is just, you know, lap stuff, coordinate stuff. It can't get modified. There's no operator dependence here. The only operators that could affect physics are operators that measure the spatial metric. And therefore, you get a deformation only of the spatial part of the energy-momentum relation, which means that the speed of light is distorted. Now, some questions and then I'll end. Is this DSR or is this broken Lorentz invariance? Well, I assumed the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. I didn't write it down and solve it for you, but I assumed we were solving it in the semi-classical approximation. And it is nothing but the statement that there's no preferred slicing, so therefore there's no preferred frame, by definition, in this Hamiltonian approach to quantum gravity. So therefore there's no Lorentz symmetry breaking in the sense of a preferred frame. Therefore, this must be DSR. That is, if I've chosen a different Hamilton-Jacobi function that led to a different slicing, I would have gotten the same result with that other slicing, whatever that other slicing was. Can a value of alpha be predicted? Yes, in principle, in a more detailed treatment, it requires doing some renormalization of the couplings in the matter Hamiltonian. See the paper for details about that. Although I don't have an answer in a particular theory. What is the meaning of the energy dependence of the metric for a general state? This is the question that Daniel always asks. And the answer is you have to go back to the definition that this is quantum field theory, and the metric is an operator, and this is the operator, this is the effect of the operator on the matter part of the quantum field, or the quantum state, the quantum field. So if this is not an energy eigenstate, then some superposition of energy eigenstates, then the operator that you have to evaluate is that operator, the d by dt operator. And so that's the answer to what about multi-particle states and so forth. Is this a form of DSR that predicts an energy-dependent speed of light? Yes, I just said that, because you only modify the spatial part of the energy-momentum relation. Hence, DSR in the form of an energy-dependent metric is a consequence of quantum gravity in the semi-classical approximation. I didn't assume anything about precisely solving the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. I didn't do anything that supersymmetry would have a problem with. I didn't do anything that depended on the dimension. I just used the fact, which we know is true, that there's a formulation of any general activity or any variant supersymmetrized coupled to matter, etc., in any dimension where the configuration variable is a connection variable. And that's all I used. And then I did standard semi-classical physics. Hence, a parity even energy-dependent speed of light is at this level of approximation a prediction of quantum gravity in the semi-classical approximation.
Could you tell me what is the difference of your model for our deep particle, where we have exactly the same thing, please?
I don't know. Okay.
DSR for me is just general coordinate transformations. Okay? The space is just not flat. I'm just saying that this statement, just...
Okay.
Let me,
I think I'm over time, so I'll stop here. I had two other topics, which were really about whether vacuum energy, whether dark energy could be a quantum gravity effect, and whether that, and secondly, about the issue of non-locality and how it arises in some versions of quantum gravity. The moral of that is just that something that John Ellis said, we should look for the quantum gravity effects that we expect, but we should look for quantum gravity effects that nobody expects, especially because they will be things that are not consequences of standard quantum field theory and general relativity. The killer quantum gravity prediction that we're looking for will be one that's almost incomprehensible on the basis of standard quantum field theory and general relativity. And I think we should be alert to such possibilities. Such a drastic change in our understanding of physics should not come without some rewards. Now, to summarize, quantum gravity phenomenology is real, quantum gravity experiment is real, and this is great news, but we theorists have a lot of work to do to catch up with the experiments, and especially with the experiments that are coming in the not-too-distant future, so that we can be making completely reliable and robust statements about what the implications of those experiments are for theory. So thank you.
So I was just wondering if, well, once one rules out such dispersion relations by future tests, let's say, what would you then conclude if that happened? What's the
house? I was very worried about that. I thought about that last night. If I wanted to be slippery, I could say the value of alpha turns out in real theory to be ratios of constants, some of which require renormalization, and it might get renormalized away to a very small value or something like that. But I don't have a convincing version of such a calculation to offer, so it's a soft prediction that is the value of alpha is not fixed, but it comes out generically of order one. I think that I'm take the full force of your question. If at some level this is not seen, then I think it means that there's some wrong assumption that is the right theory of quantum space-time doesn't completely allow us to go down to the semi-classical level in such a naive way. Next, Seth.
Yeah, so just a question on the context. Suppose you just view this all as the Yang-Mills theory exercise. What is your conclusion with that?
Something played a crucial role, which was that the Hamiltonian constraint annihilated this state, and that in more detail, that was a gravity piece and a matter piece involving the matter field and its momentum, and that this acted on the product psi zero chi in such a way that in the same approximation, this becomes ID by dt minus H matter with the gravitational dependence the operators replaced by the classical values. Okay, so this little thing intervened. That was why I could say that there were energy eigenstates of the matter Hamiltonian. Okay. And so that's very different from Yang-Mills theory.
Since you seem to have a rather complete setup, shouldn't you be able to extract from this setup directly the form of the boosts and translations and everything and show us the realization of BSR coming out of this thing just in the form of...
But it's some work, and the thing that I focused on that has prevented me from doing that is that the pile of constants that becomes alpha pile up in front of here and interact with the renormalization of the matter Hamiltonian, and I've been trying to get that off straightened out so alpha would come out as a number. But you're right, yes.
Okay, a comment on testing special relativity up to gamma factor 10 to 11. I mean, there's another way you could think of this as well. Neutrinos, the largest neutrino is in the EV range. And I think in accelerator experiments, we've already seen TeV scale neutrinos, and all the kinematics is doing pretty much what we expect. So okay. You could almost argue from that observational data in the accelerators with an elementary particle has tested relativity out to about 10 to the 12.
All the better.
Now we'll give you a really scary one.
Yeah.
Photons. We've certainly seen photons into the TeV range.
Yeah.
And the limit on the mass of the photon is about 10 to the minus 16 TeV. That gives you a gamma factor of about 10 to the 28. Now, you might argue that gamma factor is an inappropriate figure of merit for using photons, but if the photon's truly massless, we tested special relativity up to gamma factor infinity. So maybe you should argue that gamma is the inappropriate figure of merit, but with a conservative estimate of 10 to the minus 16 eV versus stuff we've seen up to the TeV range, it's still up to about 10 to the 28.
But I still felt it was worth saying. I mean, another way to say it is that these protons that, you know, in our frame are traveling for hundreds of millions of years on the way here travel for a few seconds in their reference frame.
But also,
it's
not enough to see a neutrino.
You want to see the kinematics is doing what we expect.
It's not enough using neutrino as one thing to say that you have tested gamma factors.
No, I'm not saying the simple production is enough. I'm saying there's additional information done in terms of looking at cross sections and seeing the cross sections are doing what we expect.
You just see them as missing energy, Martin. I don't think you do much.
To get the constraint in effective theory for the reaction, that to start getting constrained, you need to have above the TeV, actually, 10 to the 20 EV neutrinos. And you need fluxes. You don't need one.
And then the C energy neutrinos are missing energy, and therefore you need very little kinematics.
So
anyway, it was just really a party point to make us feel good and give us something to talk about at parties.
So next up, John Lindsay.
Okay.
Sorry to express my confusion, but if you don't mind, I know how this is very different office in the room. They always do a different office of translation and the move to speed of light on your own. But you somehow say that DSR is perfectly from the
No, I'm saying that at the order, I did everything in a coordinate system related to the Hamilton-Jacobi solution of the Hamilton-Jacobi equation. And I worked honestly within a physically defined coordinate system, and the result is meaningful. If I used another coordinate system, I would get another result. And as Daniel said, I ought to be able to figure out the corrections to Lorentz transformations by examining that. I haven't done that yet.
Something?
Yeah, about the neutrinos, since it was mentioned.
First of all, there are two things on quantum gravity. One is this approach, that quantum gravity may lead to modified dispersion relations, which may not be true if you have a statistically, you know, if you have a stochastic space-time, which microscopically it will have what you say, so you will have energy dependence, but on average, the space-time will look microscopic, and only the fluctuations. So that answers back to the same question, what happens if you can't see anything? It's not necessarily that you're wrong. The effects are average to zero. But for the neutrinos, the dispersion relations of neutrinos affect the oscillations, right? So between, you know, between oscillations because they have different masses. So a linear dispersion relation already affects the current, for neutrinos already is on the verge of certain terrestrial neutrino experiments because you understand the Hamiltonian of the that enters the neutrino oscillation changes, so you can replace linear. When, of course, we get to very high energy neutrinos, 10 to the 18 eV, hopefully from Ice Cube or another experiment, then for sure, because this would come from gamma ray bursts, right? Mm-hmm. So, offset equals 1. For sure, we would be able of testing this neutrino oscillation with unprecedented precision. And the neutrinos is the best example because for stochastic violations of gravity, which were much earlier before this, you know, already the neutral counts have the alpha, beta, gamma, and the stochastic things of order of Planck, but the neutrinos already point out that these stochastic violations are 10 to the minus 27 GeV. So already this tells you that the importance of dealing with fundamental particles rather than kaons.
You think we could study oscillations?
I did.
So stimulation for the 10 to 18 electron volt Venus?
If the dispersion relation is modified, then you will see the flux coming here, they would be completely dispersed. So you will see much less than what, then you need a mechanism for the source, for the production, of course. But in principle,
do you mean the oscillation between, say, electron, neutrino,
yeah, and electron? Yeah, you mean mu, as it travels, it would oscillate. So if the dispersion relation is modified, this would affect the period of oscillation. It does. I mean, because of the Hamiltonian, you know, because of the sign.
Anyway, let me say that I think we should have a last question.
Right,
this is the last question. But this is a good topic for the next workshop. It sounds like in future workshops to come. You're not the first person who's saying that attention will focus on the neutrinos.
Because they're delicate.
Okay, so okay, I will post my question again in this context now, because I think that what we have about the DSR is that you put the highly limit that is not satisfied by macroscopic part, because it's only applied to some kind of elementary part. So that has to do with your definition of elementary part. So in this case, can you control that somehow beyond this possibility? You have a clear definition of what is elementary and what is not elementary. To elementary part, it will apply this dispersion relation.
So I have not thought this through to a definite conclusion. But the conclusion that one comes to is that the pure DSR effects occur only for energy eigenstates of the matter Hamiltonian. And if, as for all large systems, you know, soccer balls are not in energy eigenstates because they're localized somewhere, there will be corrections to it. And I have not thought this through. Sabina has thought about this at some length in a recent paper. Well, there is the possibility that the answer to the soccer ball problem is that our description of macroscopic objects are not in energy momentum eigenstates precisely. Okay. And it's an idea that has been discussed by Sedina, by Zhao and Guizhou and some collaborators. And I have not thought that through. But that's what's suggested here.
Yeah, I would have a last concern following up on the point that I didn't actually. Isn't it the case that when you have different horizons for different particles, you might get a modified Penrose mechanism that would get you violation on the second law. But if you have an energy-dependent metric, you have an energy-dependent location of horizon, couldn't that lead to a problem?
So again, so there are many confusing things that you can say, okay. But if I can come back to, you know, this equation does not say that in all circumstances the leading order quantum effect is an energy dependence. It says the leading order quantum effect is an energy dependence, sorry to repeat myself, only in the case that the matter part of the state is in an energy eigenstate of the matter part of the Hamiltonian in the semi-classical approximation. And if you want to work anything else out, anything that's a superposition, you have to go back to the, remember that the metric is an operator. I mean, the key result is that the operator that represents the metric acts not just on the gravity dependence on the wave function in the gravity part of the state, it also necessarily acts on the matter part of the state, and that has to be taken into account. That's, in some sense, that's the beginning and the ending of it, and whatever the consequences of can be deduced.
We are out of time. Let me turn the word over to the chief organizer of this workshop, Selina.